I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mark Edge joins me again. He's just published a new book, The News We Deserve, The Transformation of Canada's Media Landscape. In this engaging book, Mark chronicles how we've gotten to where we are with our media in Canada today. We've seen radical changes in the media today as opposed to how it was 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 25 years ago. Mark looks at the people and policies that have brought us here, whether it was mergers, swaps, the influence of governments, the influence on governments to change regulations, to colorful figures who ambitiously set out to reshape the media in their own image. How we got here is a good way to see where we're headed. And by virtue of the title of the book, it'll be a good chance to see what sort of media we ought to have. I'll ask Mark about whether we can and how we can get to a media landscape that is diverse and independent. I'll also ask Mark about the role government can play and whether that role should be bigger than it is. Mark Edge is a former reporter and editor. He's been on this program before for his books Greatly Exaggerated, The Myth of the Death of Newspapers, and Aspernation, Canada's Most Dangerous Media Company. His first book was Pacific Press, The Unauthorized Story of Vancouver's Newspaper Monopoly, A Great History of the Media in This Town. He has taught journalism and communications in departments around the world. The website for more is at markedge.com. This new book is published by New Star Books. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Mark Edge. Dr. Edge, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for, it's nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in to do this.
Nice to be with you again.
So I read this book, and I think, really considering where we are and where we're headed, because a lot of us who are media consumers are worried about where we're going to get our news in the future. For you, when you look back at, say, your career in the media, when you look back at the narrative that's in this book, it seems that it was bound to happen. I mean, is that your sense, looking back at it all?
Well, there is this concept in law called the slippery slope, that certain events, once engaged in or authorized, inevitably lead to certain other future events. And people have been saying for decades, starting back in the 1960s with the first big inquiry into Canadian media, the Special Senate Committee on Mass Media chaired by Keith Davey, they've been saying, and then followed by, of course, the Royal Commission on Newspapers in 1980-81, they said unless something was done, economic forces towards consolidation being what they are, inevitably Canada's news media would be owned just by a very few large corporations. And so it was easily foreseeable. The problem has been that there's been nothing done to halt or even slow this trend towards consolidation, and we now find ourselves in a situation where something must be done.
But isn't that the case, though, with other sectors? I mean, you look at the automobile industry, you look at even manufacturing, certain manufacturing industries that you had, say, 20 companies 50 years ago, and now, say, 10, 5 even?
Yes, that's certainly true, but the thing about it is that the auto industry is hardly central to our democracy, as the news media are. The news media play a very important role in politics and society, and to have them controlled not just by a very few large players, but now foreign hedge funds, it's all very disturbing.
Where could it have been stopped? I mean, was there a point in the last, say, 20 years, 30 years where the tide could have been stemmed, if you will?
Well, it could have been stopped in its tracks in the early 1970s with the report of the Davy Committee, which recommended a media ownership review board, which would have approved or most likely disapproved, as it noted, any consolidations of news media organizations. That was never implemented, and so it was perhaps inevitable that Black Wednesday occurred on August 27th, 1980, when the Winnipeg Tribune was closed and the Ottawa Journal was closed and the Vancouver Sun was sold to Southam, which already owned the Vancouver province. And that was the precipitating event for the Royal Commission on Newspapers, called very quickly by the first Prime Minister Trudeau and reported within a year with recommendations to limit growth of the chains. But as I mentioned in the book, this, while it was one of the best chances for media ownership reform, unfortunately, we've seen a pattern where the best chances for media ownership reform are quickly followed by changes in government from liberal to conservative, and the conservatives much less likely to put any restrictions on ownership. And this time, hopefully it's different because we have a switch the opposite way from conservative to liberal. And this is why I went to see Hedy Fry, Vancouver Centre MP, after the Post Media Network acquired Sun Media, the largest newspaper company in Canada, buying the second largest.
Mm-hmm.
And then, despite their promises to the contrary, merging their newsrooms in Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, and Ottawa, despite the fact that in Vancouver that promise was an official promise dating from the 1950s, upon the merger of the Sun and Province, that they would maintain separate newsrooms. So I figured that something had to be done rather than just writing about things, as I'd been doing for almost 20 years. I decided to actually do something about it and take action. And I thought, who might have the power to do something about this? And I decided, well, Hedy Fry was the longest-serving MP in the new Liberal government. And so I went and took her a copy of my first book on Pacific mm-hmm. Press, and I took her a copy of my most recent book, Greatly Exaggerated, which shows that newspapers are hardly losing money, as they tend to portray. And she was quite shocked. She said, oh, I thought they were losing money. No, they're not losing money. Mm-hmm. They like to make us think they're losing money, but they're not. And so it was only a few weeks later that she convened hearings on media and local communities. So that's why I'm hopeful that this time something will happen.
And so that will, I guess, make recommendations to the government, and hopefully this government is receptive to those, and we can see some of the reforms that you'd like to see, right?
Yes, hopefully. The committee has already issued an interim report, which merely summarizes the testimony that it's heard to date from ever since February. They've heard from dozens of witnesses, but it makes no recommendations or conclusions that presumably will be in the final report, at which point it will be up to government to act, to enact some sort of legislation, and there's no shortage of suggestions as to what might be done. Unfortunately, you have to walk kind of a fine line without infringing on press freedom. I would, for example, personally, as a longtime journalist, I'd be very leery of direct government subsidies to the press, because this would create the possibility of government influence over the news. I think that any program of assistance or subsidies or tax incentives has to be at least one arm's length to preserve the independence of the press.
And one of the things you talk about in the book, and I guess this was Paul Godfrey, who runs the Post Media Empire, he suggests a sort of different tax rate when it comes to ads.
Yes.
And that would be a little more suitable to most people, right?
Paul Godfrey testified to the Heritage Committee on News, Media, and Local Communities, and he actually suggested that Canadian corporations, such as his, should get higher tax breaks, ignoring the fact, of course, that his company, Post Media Network, is owned, I think it's almost 98% now, by U.S. hedge funds. Suggestion is to take that and tweak it just a bit and to encourage local ownership. I believe that local owners should be allowed, or advertisers in locally owned media should be allowed to write the expense off at a higher rate or be given some other tax incentives or tax credits to encourage more local ownership rather than the absentee corporate ownership, which we've seen ever since the 1960s.
Now, you mentioned that you wouldn't want the government to say offer subsidies because it would, say, influence the media's coverage. Do you think that happens at the CBC?
Not directly, but some conservatives do complain that the CBC does tend to be fairly liberal, The same thing in the UK. There's lots of complaints from conservatives there that the BBC is liberal, and I think that's understandable, that it is liberal. It tends to be more inclusive. Conservatives tend to be more exclusive. There are many reasons that that journalists tend to be more liberal than the population as a whole. However, owners of privately owned media tend to be more conservative for some very good reasons as well. So there are many different aspects to this. It's a fascinating study. And so I think we have to be careful what we do, but we have to do something.
So your previous book, Greatly Exaggerated, talked about how, because this is what we're told, that newspapers are dying and they're not making any money. And so you proved in that book that they are actually profitable and could be profitable in the future. So this idea that the model of journalism, as say, in your years there, I mean, that's like 20, 25 years now since you've been in daily journalism, was unsustainable. Is that true? Was that?
The problem is that this post-war advertising bubble that grew up was extremely profitable for newspapers. It's now burst. Okay, they used to make a killing on classified ads because they basically had a monopoly on them. With the internet now, of course, they no longer have a monopoly on either news or classified ads, and so that river of revenue has dried up. However, newspapers are extremely vertically integrated. They buy their raw materials in bulk, like paper and ink, and so they're able to generate an enviable profit margin despite their reduced revenues, because they seem to be very scalable. They can cut their costs and their expenses almost as quickly as the revenues decline. So while they are still making money, and in most cases double-digit profit margins, their revenues and thus their earnings are much lower than they used to be, less than a half, even a third of what they used to be. So what's going down is the value of newspapers, not their profitability. It's the value of newspapers, and that's what they deduct from their annual earnings to claim that they're losing money. They're not losing money, they're losing value. But newspapers are just growing smaller. I believe they'll continue to survive, but they'll just be one fish in the pond. They'll no longer be the big fish. Digital media are growing into what might turn out to be the big fish, but the problem with digital media is that nobody's really figured out how to make money on it except for Google and Facebook, search engines and social networks. Most online news outlets are unprofitable and need to be subsidized either by readers or philanthropists. So that's one area in which the government could assist by giving some sort of tax incentives to donate to online news media. Part of the problem in Canada is that our charitable giving laws are antiquated. In the U.S., for example, under Section 501 C3, I believe it is, of the U.S. tax code, media may accept tax-deductible donations, and there's been what Ian Gill describes as a bit of a digital gold rush south of the border, especially since the election. A lot of people have been donating to independent media. Well, they can't do that in Canada, because up here that would be classified as a political activity, which is not allowed under the rules surrounding charitable giving.
Yeah, and that's why you don't see foundations playing a part in journalism as you do in the United States. You watch like the PBS Frontline or something, and then there's a whole list of foundations and grant-giving bodies that fund this stuff.
Exactly, and they fund organizations like ProPublica, which do great investigative reporting, and they farm it out. They have it published in different media, newspapers, radio, television. There are local news outlets like the Min Post and Voice of San Diego that are extremely successful and provide good journalism, and state media such as the Texas Tribune, which do a lot of good political reporting. So that's what we need to see more of up here in Canada.
And so the other myth that I guess that we are told is that younger citizens, viewers, listeners, readers, don't value news as much, and so they're not paying for it. I mean, what's your experience? Did you find that, younger generations are not investing in the media, and why not? I mean, could those habits be changed, say?
Well, I didn't research that directly, but I have read research on this, and there are several factors at play here. First of all, young people have never really taken an interest in the news over the decades. It's only when they get a little bit older, maybe get married and have kids and start paying taxes, that they want to know, you know, how their tax dollars are being spent and take an interest in local government and provincial and federal government. Second of all, the young people today, they've just learned how to get their information from different sources. So when they do grow up and take more of an interest in the news, it's more likely that they will get it from digital sources rather from print sources. So there's a few things going on here, and they all have to be kept in mind.
And so we're seeing with this previous election, the American election, the misinformation that can happen on social media, Facebook especially.
This is the latest worrying trend, and some research has been done into so-called native advertising, which shows that people can't really tell the difference between what are called sponsored content or journalism. And fake news takes it one step further. I'm sure a lot of people can't tell the difference between real news and fake news. And so something has to be done about this as well. There used to be a law in Canada, you know, for spreading false news. This was struck down about 25 years ago in the Ernst Zundel case. I think we maybe need to reenact that legislation, perhaps in a form that's okay with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which Section 181 was found to be contrary. It needs to be somehow rewritten so that it's compatible with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
So in the book, you name some people who might be to blame for where we are. And I guess, I mean, whenever something happens in our culture, we're looking for someone to blame. I mean, who are some of these folks?
Well, I don't know if blame is the right word. I think, you know, profit-making corporations, they just do what comes naturally to them. A lot of people blame Paul Godfrey, who was hired by the hedge funds because of his past experience with Sun Media. He knew how to run a newspaper company quite profitably, and he's done an excellent job for them. Unfortunately, he hasn't done an excellent job for Canadians, because it's really dried up, to a large extent, a lot of our sources of news.
Yeah, so he's well compensated for his work, and will continue to be, it seems, as our media in this town has shrunk. Does this continue, do you think, into the foreseeable future?
I think until somebody stops them, they'll continue to do what they can to make more money, and the only power to stop them will come from the government. The government should have taken action years ago. I'm sure that they're laughing all the way to the bank, to a certain extent, these hedge funds, because there are supposed to be laws in Canada on foreign ownership of media. It's supposed to be 25%. Well, they found a loophole in that regulation, and they took most of their ownership as non-voting shares, claiming, oh, that the few Canadian shareholders are the ones that have control of the company. Ironically, this is a loophole that was exploited in Australia, which is an episode that I recount in the book. Izzy Asper and Conrad Black. Asper, being a clever tax lawyer, found a loophole in the Australian media ownership laws, which nominally prevented him from owning more than 25% of Network 10 down there. And he took about another third in debentures, debt. So he owned the debt. And the interest paid on the debt was equivalent to the profit rate of the company. So that was a very clever end run around Australia's foreign ownership limits. And as a result, they've been largely lifted. I don't think we want to do that in Canada, being so close to the U.S., this has been a concern going back to the early days of radio, the influence of U.S. Media on Canadian culture. So we have to do something that gives some of these laws some teeth, the foreign ownership laws, also the competition laws, which the Competition Bureau has been nothing less than derelict in its duty to prevent media ownership consolidation. And that doesn't come just from me. That comes from a Senate report in 2006, which accused not only the Competition Bureau, but the CRTC of nothing short of neglect when it comes to Canada's media industries. Unfortunately, and even tragically, like I say, the report of the 2006 Senate committee, which made some recommendations that would have helped alleviate this problem, the Harper Conservatives had already been elected earlier that year with a minority government, and they would remain in power for almost a decade. So that prevented that opportunity for media ownership reform. So now we have what I consider to be our last chance for media ownership reform. If something isn't done now, you might as well just forget about the whole thing.
You also talk in the book about the role that academia has played in everything. I was surprised to find out that the J schools, journalism schools, and it didn't really flourish in this part of the world until very recently.
Yes, journalism and education in Canada has followed much more of the UK model. When I grew up in Burnaby, I wanted to be a journalist, but the only journalism program in town was a two-year diploma program at Langara. I wanted to go to university and get a degree, so yeah. I did what everyone suggested I should do if I wanted to be a journalist, was study something else and work on the student newspaper. Which is what I did. I worked on the Peak for 4 years, and as a result, I was able to get an entry-level job at the Calgary Herald. Many of the best journalists in BC history, even Canadian history, have worked at the UBC in Vancouver, the UBC student newspaper, Pierre Burton, Alan Fotheringham, many others. But now, there's been more and more journalism programs started up starting in the 1990s in BC. Now we have about a half a dozen of them. There's the program at Kwantlen, there's one at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, and of course there's the Graduate School of Journalism at UBC. But in my research over the past 15 years, I've found some uncomfortable connections between journalism schools and the mainstream media. I think it's natural to a certain extent that journalism schools don't want to ruffle the feathers of media ownership because, of course, they rely on the media to find jobs for their graduates and placement for their interns and things like this. And this has been mentioned by other authors, but even more alarmingly has been a CRTC program called Public Benefits, which requires acquiring corporations of licensed broadcasters to devote 10% of the purchase price to what are called public benefits, otherwise known as tangible benefits or significant benefits. And increasingly this money has been flowing into journalism schools in the mid-1990s. It started flowing into schools like Western Ontario, Ryerson. As a result, these schools have named chairs, named after different corporations.
The one at UBC was named at one point for a newspaper chain.
That no longer even exists. Mm-hmm. The Can West Fellowship they have at UBC. At Ryerson they have, I believe, not only a Can West Fellowship, but also a McLean Hunter Chair in Journalism Ethics. In 2000, when the big convergence deals went down, when Bell Canada bought the CTV network at a price of $2.3 billion, well, that required a public benefits package of $230 million. And so you saw journalism schools lining up at the trough to get a piece of this money. Some of it went to Ryerson. $3.5 million of it went to a consortium of journalism schools headquartered at UBC here in Vancouver, and also including Ryerson and Laval. The University of King's College was initially included, but they opted out. They saw some ethical difficulties with it, as did the Canadian Journalism Foundation, opted out when the conflicts of interest were pointed out, but the remaining three journalism schools apparently didn't have any problem with the conflicts of interest. And some of the research that they've done has been very friendly towards media ownership. In fact, the former director of the School of Journalism at UBC, Donald Logan, has actively advocated for increased consolidation and convergence of media, which convergence, to my mind, ruined Canadian media 15 years ago. I thought it was a bad idea, but she was one of the largest proponents of...
You've got a letter from her in the book, right?
Yes, yeah. And so I've actually, I was able to download from the CRTC website some letters from academics to the CRTC actually advocating for increased consolidation and convergence. And this is very troubling. And so one of the recommendations that I make in the book is that there be the CRTC exempt or prohibit journalism schools from receiving funding under the public benefits program. I think the journalism schools have something to make up in this regard. And it's unfortunate that there's almost no critical scholarship of journalism in Canada in journalism schools. There's some in schools of communication. Myself, for example, as a critical scholar of journalism, I've been unable to secure an appointment in Canada at a journalism school for some reason, and this is why I'm taking an appointment starting next month at the University of Malta.
Yeah, and you've worked in schools around the world, haven't you? I mean, I talked to you once, you were in Louisiana?
I taught for 5 years in Texas.
Oh, Texas, that's it.
I taught for 3 years in Singapore.
Yeah.
I taught in Fiji at the University of the South Pacific, where I was head of the journalism program there until I was run off by the military dictatorship. So with my credentials, I can teach anywhere in the world except, it seems, in Canada. And I've applied many times. And one of the more troubling aspects of this is that journalism schools tend to be quite happy to hire foreigners, whereas they are required to state in their position announcements that Canadian citizens will be given first opportunity. This doesn't seem to be true in practice. UBC, they've hired faculty members from the UK, the US, up at Thompson Rivers University, where I taught for a year. They hired an American to take the position that I had applied for, and the same thing across the country. So something's not quite right here.
I wonder what. So when you look at the ideal of a diverse, independent media, what would that look like? And I guess more importantly, where is it today? Well, what can we look towards as an example?
It's very simple. You need competition. And competition is what we don't have, especially here in Vancouver. The competition began disappearing in 1957 when the Vancouver Sun and the Vancouver Province went into business together, and it's been disappearing ever since. In fact, as recently as September, when Post Media closed the newsroom of the commuter tabloid it owns, 24 Hours, and so it now will merely print stories that have appeared in the National Post, the Vancouver Sun and Province. And it's a new concept in journalism, a newspaper without a newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps this is the ultimate consequence of the disappearance of competition.
And so do you find that because the same stories are in those three papers, the Sun, the Province, and 24 Hours, their readership, I guess, I mean, inevitably it'll decline, right?
Well, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. Why should people buy the National Post or the Vancouver Sun when they can read the same stories in the 24 Hours? As cagey as the owners, are of both media networks, these hedge funds, I don't think they understand journalism. And I think the merging of the newsrooms, while it might have saved them some money, I think it's going to be detrimental in the long term. And so one can only hope that ownership of the now two largest newspaper chains in Canada passes to owners that are more conversant with the practice of journalism.
The thing is, I was going to suggest, because you said something about local ownership, someone could buy Post Media, but the value, as you said, has gone down, and they're carrying a heavy debt, so that's why it's not palatable for someone to come in and buy the assets, right?
Well, that's true, but the problem is that the way that the hedge funds make their money is through the debt, because they hold so much debt, they skim millions, tens of millions off the top every year. The problem is that the earnings have been going down to a point where they don't cover the debt, so as a result, they voluntarily extinguished about half of their debt earlier this year in what I describe as a voluntary mini-bankruptcy, and they gave the debt holders shares in the company, which are virtually useless, but the shareholders and the debt holders are basically the same people, mostly the U.S. hedge funds, so it seems like a bit of a shell game to me. What this is it's financial engineering. They're doing whatever they can to make as much money as they can. The lead hedge fund, at least, Golden Tree Asset Management, seemed to get fed up after 6 years of this nonsense, and they sold to another hedge fund. I believe it's Chatham Asset Management. And one of the largest hedge funds now is at least Canadian. So perhaps that's an improvement. I'm not sure. But what I would like to see are some incentives for Post Media Network to sell some of its newspapers off to local ownership. Certainly there can be some tax incentives provided for this, and to bring back local ownership and to bring back local journalism.
Somebody would like to buy the Sun or the Province and run it from here, right?
Jimmy Pattison has wanted for years to buy the Vancouver Sun. I'm sure he'd love to be its owner.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think will happen in the next 2-5 years or so?
What I hope will happen is that the Heritage Committee will make some recommendations that will result in a more competitive and diverse and more independent news media in Canada. What I'm afraid will happen is that whatever recommendations they make will be shouted down by big media, as has always happened in the past. But like I say, the one hope is that we do have now a new Liberal government with a strong mandate to run the country. And I think this is one of the biggest issues on their plate at the moment. So hopefully something will happen soon.
What when you look at the media, because it has shrunk in this market, especially in this town, the town that you worked in many years ago, when you look at the broadcast, print, do you think we're well served by the media we have?
I think it has to be acknowledged that things actually improved for a while after the bankruptcy of Canwest Global Communications. We had deconvergence of media, where Canwest at one point owned the largest television station in the province, a provincial superstation, BCTV, or Global BC, as they renamed it.
Yeah.
Both local daily newspapers, the Vancouver Sun and Province, one of the national daily newspapers, the National Post, and most of the other non-daily newspapers in the Lower Mainland.
The community ones, the weeklies and the bi-weeklies.
The Vancouver or the Now newspapers, the North Shore News, and now that's been split up with their bankruptcy. Shaw now owns Global TV. Post Media took the newspapers out of bankruptcy and almost immediately sold most of the community newspapers to Glacier Media. But Glacier Media now and Black Press in Victoria, they seem to be carving up the provincial press between them and quite worryingly buying, trading, and closing many of the newspapers. The latest research I've been doing since the book went to press shows that while there were 36 daily newspapers in BC at the start of this decade, there are something like 15 now, so fewer than half. And most of them have been closed after they've been traded or acquired between Black Press and Glacier Media. So This is another matter in which I believe the Competition Bureau has been derelict in its duty. I've requested from the Competition Bureau information regarding its approval of the purchase of Sun Media by Post Media. They've refused to provide me with their market analysis, claiming that it's confidential. We've now gone from a situation where in 1980, the closure of a few newspapers across Canada resulted in nothing less than a royal commission, which produced not only a report, but, almost a dozen research studies and held public hearings. When the Southam Incorporated, the owner of the Vancouver Sun and Province, bought most of the community newspapers in the Lower Mainland in the late 1980s, at least the Competition Bureau held hearings. But when the largest newspaper company in Canada bought the second largest newspaper company in Canada 2 years ago, not only was it adjudicated in secret, but they won't even release the research on which its approval was based. So something's not quite right here.
Yeah. In the ideal media landscape for you, what place would the CBC have?
The CBC would have a leading role. I believe it's important to have a quality public broadcaster. There's an old saying that a rising tide lifts all boats. In the UK, it's been shown to improve the quality of journalism all round, and I believe it could do so in Canada, given increased funding, or even just the restoration of the funding that was cut by the previous Conservative government. I have made some recommendations in the book for local journalism to be practiced across the country by what are called mojos, mobile journalists, writing and filing online. They could also feed into the CBC, which is the existing national network of journalism. So I think it's important to have a strong public broadcaster, but we need to have more than that. We also need to have a strong privately owned media as well.
Yeah. And, I mean, you just look at the ratings for the CBC, especially radio. I mean, that's what people are relying on. So it's not like people are not tuning in. I mean, the numbers for CBC radio nationally and locally are higher than, say, they were in their heyday with Zosky and Barbara Frum and the sort, right?
Yes. Some of the places that I've traveled and spent some time in on my boat, such as Prince Rupert and Port Hardy, the CBC is the main media outlet, and people do rely on it. So I think, we have more of a diversity of news sources in the metropolitan areas, but it's the outlying areas, the smaller communities, which this Heritage Committee was looking at specifically, they're the ones that are suffering the most from not only the disappearance of competition, but the diminution of the CBC.
You know, you mentioned how hard it is for you to find work as an instructor, as a professor of journalism. You left Daily Journalism 25 years ago. Why have you stuck with it? I mean, despite, to say, just how shitty a business it is, but also, you know, you've gotten banged about, you know, quite a bit. I mean, why haven't you gone to, say, the dark side and worked in communications like most people have in your business?
Well, you have to follow your heart, and I could never work on the dark side, I'm afraid. I think once a journalist, always a journalist in my case. But what I'm doing is a lot like journalism. It's digging up facts and writing about them. Unfortunately, I've been writing about them mostly in obscure academic journals, and that's why I was so pleased when my publisher suggested putting some of these articles together in the form of this book, because it really is now, it's the culmination of research I've been doing for 15 to 20 years. And it's not so bad being what's called a gypsy scholar. I get to see interesting parts of the world, and the pay is actually not too bad. But part of me wishes I could make a difference in my own country, and I think I can have a limited effect outside of the country, although everywhere I go, Canadian media is my main research interest. I think as I've been teaching for the past year and a bit at University of Canada West, it has been more convenient, certainly, to speak out on a lot of these issues when you're present. Certainly, given the technology, I can do interviews from Malta and write from Malta, but it won't be quite the same as being in Canada.
So you are hopeful, though?
I am hopeful. I'm hoping the tide will finally turn. But then I hoped the tide would turn 10 years ago when I wrote Aspernation. It doesn't seem to have, but I continue to hold out hope.
Yeah, well, hopefully the next time we talk, we'll have better circumstances amidst us to talk about.
Even if not, we'll hopefully have another book to talk about.
Indeed. Congratulations on this book, Mark, and continued good luck with it and everything else.
Thank you very much.
MarkEdge.com is the website. The book is called The News We Deserve, The Transformation of Canada's Media Landscape. It's published by New Star Books. Mark Edge joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.